It's been really a great pleasure for me in preparing for this symposium to get to know Ed Hundert a little bit more. He was a few years ahead of me at Harvard Medical School, and in reviewing his biography, I just am absolutely astounded at how much this person has accomplished. Dean Edward M. Hundert is the Dean for Medical Education. He's also the Dan Fetterman Professor of Global Health and Social Medicine. He earned his bachelor's degree in mathematics and the history of science and medicine, summa cum laude, from Yale University. He attended Oxford on a Marshall Scholarship, where he received the Batterby Prize from Hertford College for the highest first-class honors in philosophy, politics, and economics. 4 years later, he earned his MD from Harvard Medical School, where he received the Sanger Prize for Excellence in Psychiatric Research. He completed a psychiatry residency at the McLean, where he served as chief resident, and he has received a remarkable number of teaching awards, mentoring awards, diversity awards. He was voted the faculty member who did the most for the class by 5 different classes of Harvard medical students. There's 10,000 faculty at Harvard. So he brings to HMS a remarkably distinguished intellectual past. But what I've also learned is this enormously impressive record of institutional leadership. Dean Hundert was Dean of the University of Rochester School of Medicine, and then also the president of Case Western University. You know, I feel it's kind of like, you know, getting Pablo Sandoval to the Red Sox. We are absolutely fortunate to have this guy back at HMS. Anyway, my pleasure to introduce Dean Hundert.
Very much, George. He was so gracious to introduce me. I think we should give a round of applause. That was one of the best talks I've ever heard. And I want to thank Tenley and Niall and George for inviting me to talk about the next logical step in this question, which is if this is how science and technology is changing this rapidly, the prospect of thinking about how to train the next generation of doctors to practice in a world like this is extremely exciting and inspiring and terrifying. And one of the greatest things about being invited and getting to know George better is that I got to, as we were preparing for this, go over to his lab and spend an hour, and he was showing me these stem cells under the microscope. And it's absolutely thrilling. And for those of you who are specifically interested in that question, you are invited tomorrow afternoon. The Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School is hosting the leading scholar in the ethical issues of genome manipulation from Stanford, Sandra Lee, who heads their ELSI project, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues in Genomic Medicine, will be here at 4:30 in room 227 in the TMEC building, giving a talk on these very issues. What I wanted to do in taking up this challenge, so how do we prepare the next generation of physicians, scientists, humanist leaders who are going to be able to practice in a world like George just described, and obviously, you know, talk about this in the context of how we're trying to rethink our curriculum and how we're going to do this here at Harvard Medical School. But before I do, I have two very important preambles I want to share. The first is that changing a medical curriculum in order to anticipate the practice in this new scientific era is only one of the reasons why you would change the curriculum. Because there are other reasons as well that I'm not gonna spend time on today, but there are new educational technologies. Even if science were standing still, there are so many new ways to think about education because of advances in educational technology. There are new advances in what we know about how adults learn. And there are certainly a lot of new outcome studies suggesting there are different ways we should educate millennials who come to class with different expectations and so forth. So there are a lot of reasons, and certainly the practice of medicine, the organization of medicine is changing so much, we would have to change the clinical parts of our curriculum just to reflect the way medicine is being changed in its organizational structure. But for this purpose, I just want to take 15 or 20 minutes and talk about specifically the logical rejoinders. How are we going to train people for this next generation of exponentially increasing levels of change in medical practice? So that's the first preamble. The second preamble I want to make, because my mentor, Dan Fetterman, is sitting here, and he has reminded me many times that medical education is really not about syllabi, and the curriculum may be important, but it's actually mostly about people, right? What Harvard Medical School is mostly about is getting the best students in the world together with the best faculty in the world. That's your petri dish for education, and great things will happen. And so following in his footsteps, I had the great opportunity as the new dean for medical education to welcome the students at their white coat ceremony, where the parents now all come, their families, and they have this great symbolic moment of donning a white coat and thinking about what it means to join this profession. And in greeting them, following on from Dan, I tried to remind them that in one way, and this might be a little bit counterintuitive for this talk, in one way, the 4 years of medical school are the least important part of your medical education. Now, why would you say that to someone on their first week of medical school? Well, obviously, we think it's a very important part of your medical education. I have my boss here, you know, Jeff Flyer. I think it's important, don't worry. But if you were to divide the life of these people who are going to be practicing, we send out our admissions letters. We have our dean of admissions here. We sent our admissions letters yesterday. So a new class is coming. We have to prepare them for this world. And if I were to say to them, we want to divide your life as our new admitted class into three epochs: before you came to medical school, the 4 years of medical school, and all the years after medical school, it's pretty obvious that all the years after medical school are a lot more important. They're going to learn much, much more medicine during the next 40 years before they retire than they're going to learn in medical school. And in fact, we historically greet people at Harvard Medical School by telling them that we expect that about half, at least half, of what we teach you in medical school is going to turn out to be wrong, or at least irrelevant, by the time you retire from practice. And the problem is, we don't know which half. So truly, the goal of a medical education is not to learn medicine, it's to learn how to learn medicine for a lifetime. So that is the goal, and has always been, has to be the goal. But if you were to think of those three epochs, the most important part of their medical education is actually the time before they came to medical school, right? That is the time when their character, their moral development, their other orientedness, the kind of person who wants to devote themselves to others, all of those personal, ethical, and characterological features that make the kind of doctor who will deal with these issues responsibly are formed before they come here. And that actually is something I love to tell the parents, because in that regard, the parents are actually the most important faculty of Harvard Medical School, although, as Jeff would quickly point out, there's a big difference between those faculty and the faculty here, and that is in the parental role. You are first given tenure in the job and then the opportunity to prove you deserve it. Whereas you'll be glad to know we do that the other way around here on campus. So with that other preamble, let me talk a little bit about the challenge of how would you design a curriculum that is truly designed to learn how to learn medicine for a lifetime? Because this is not a new idea. If I was going to, I usually don't use slides, but if I was going to show one slide, I would show a quotation from John Shaw Billings, who in a commencement address at Johns Hopkins has this wonderful quote in which he says, "With all of the new advances in medicine happening so rapidly, we surely have to change our curriculum so that the goal of medical education is to learn how to learn medicine for a lifetime." John Shaw Billings, 1888. 1888, that was his commencement address. So this isn't a new idea, but the question is, how has our educational system actually changed to try to no longer think about just transmission of information, drinking from the fire hose? Every time, you know, knowledge doubles, I guess we just have to talk twice as fast. You know, that's been, you know, the sort of watchword of medical education for many, many years. And so our faculty over the last 3 years have been actively involved in rethinking our curriculum, and the class that Bob just admitted yesterday is going to be coming into a new curriculum that has been designed. And I like to tell people that we're not doing a massive curriculum reform at Harvard Medical School next year. We're doing two massive curriculum reforms at Harvard Medical School next year. And the reason is that one curriculum reform is what I would call a pedagogical curriculum reform, and the other is what I might call a structural curriculum reform. And both of them are designed specifically to train people to be able to deal with a new era of rapidly changing biomedical science and technology. So the pedagogical curriculum reform is actually what people have read about. If you read the New York Times or any periodical, you know that the millennials who are coming into our educational system learn differently and expect to learn differently. They actually, if you are going to give them a lecture like this, they'll say, why didn't you record it? I could watch it at home the night before and spend my time interacting with Dr. Daly and asking him questions. That was the most inefficient way to spend my half hour. This is what they'll say. And actually, they have a point. Because if they all truly had an expectation of being, you know, held accountable for watching the lecture we just saw the night before at home and spent the time with Dr. Daly working through problems together, we would be using the time that they have with our faculty to teach them how to problem solve, to teach them how to analyze, to do the higher order level of integrating and synthesizing that we think are the requisite skills they need in order to learn how to learn medicine for a lifetime. So the faculty has been learning how to make videos, and the faculty has been learning how to move students around, and the classrooms are all being renovated for this new educational technology so that when the students arrive in August, rather than having traditional classrooms, there will be these learning studios. You've probably seen them in classrooms in other professional schools around the country that have very flexible kinds of spaces so that if you want to set a problem for the students the night before, they can come in and small groups of four arrive and try to work through some problem. Then you could get 10 of those groups together in a group of 40 and talk through, well, who's figured out what, and try to really energize them around this higher level critical thinking skills. So the goal of the curriculum in that regard becomes the how and the why, not the what. The what you should learn at home before you come. So it's a highly energized kind of curriculum. It's a curriculum in which the focus really is on the critical thinking skills, and the integration of the basic and the clinical sciences starts from week one. So many people have expressed skepticism about the possibility, but in fact, our basic science faculty got together and through endless committees and task forces and the way these things go, they agreed that they were going to hold Wednesday every day to be a clinical day from the first week of medical school. So the students are going to be thinking about these scientific questions in the context of actual patients they're going to start seeing in a longitudinal ambulatory sort of clerkship. We usually haven't talked about clerkships in the past for a first-year medical student, but it's being called the foundational clinical clerkship. And the students are going to have a chance to actually meet a patient with diabetes, meet a patient with cystic fibrosis. So when they're in those basic science rooms, they're hungry to learn because it actually matters to the people. So I guess the last thing I'll say about the pedagogical curriculum reform is that it's really about trying to engage adult learners to be thinking in a more higher level way, in a higher level way about what they're learning and why it's important. The structural curricular change is maybe even more dramatic. In a traditional 2+2 curriculum, most of us had more or less 2 years of preclinical and 2 years of clinical curriculum. The myth has always been that in the preclinical curriculum, you have to do three things. You have to learn all the basic science you're going to learn in medical school. Well, that's sort of ridiculous, right? Because nobody thinks you should learn all the basic science you're going to learn ever. The second is that you have to learn all of the basic science and clinical science you need in order to learn on the clerkships, in order to be prepared to go into the wards of our great hospitals and do what you do. And the third is you have to pass this hurdle called step one of the national board exams, which actually in our curriculum has always been a great distraction. Right now, the second year class, you can barely get them into the classroom because they're studying for the boards. You would like to think that the best way you could study for the boards would be to go to the classroom, but medical schools throughout the country face this problem. So our faculty, when they got together 3 and 2 years ago, working on a new way of thinking about this, said, you know, instead of doing those three things at once, trying to teach all the basic science you're going to learn in medical school and prepare students for the clerkships and get them ready for the national boards, why don't we only do one of those three things, the middle one? Teach them the science they need to know to be able to go into the hospitals and start to learn some medicine. And they asked the question, if you could shorten the amount of time you spent doing that, because you're only doing one of the three, and frame shift the core clerkship year earlier, you could then recapture a return to advanced science in the third and fourth year, but now with the students coming into class, the way we come to a lecture like this, the way we go to Grand Rounds, we're hungry to know the latest advances because we know something about medicine. It's not an exercise in delayed gratification, like a traditional preclinical curriculum. It's actually students hungry to learn the latest genetics and the latest biochemistry and the latest cell biology. And so in the many, many meetings that went on over these 3 years, our faculty came to the conclusion that our students at Harvard Medical School would need 14 months of preparation to do that. Now, why it's not 13, why it's not 15, I don't know. But it will be 14 months, starting with the new entering class. And because it'll be 14 intensive months of this highly engaged, problem-solving kind of curriculum, with spliced in the middle of the week with actually starting to see patients, our students will be able to start their clerkship year in October of year two, the beginning of year two. The core clerkship year will mostly be the second year, and we will be able to, in the third year, regain those 4 or 5 months that we frame shifted to have the students come back to the classroom and actually think about the advances in science, having seen patients and knowing something about disease. So that's the structural change that's happening in the curriculum. Now, there are all sorts of wonderful details about how our MD, PhD students in this curriculum, for example, will now actually, it won't be the whole clerkship year, but will be able to do almost the whole clerkship year, 9 months of their clerkships before they go off to grad school. Right now, MD, PhDs traditionally go to grad school and then come back and get exposed to medicine. Our MD, PhDs now will go off to graduate school already having some ideas about what happens when you do things with patients and so forth. So there are a lot of interesting ways in which this new structural model is going to empower students to think about research careers. Last thing I'll say about the structural change is that a really great innovation at Harvard Medical School that really arose out of the rapid changes in science just 4 years ago was the requirement that everyone do a scholarly project. Every student in the graduating class right now has to write something of a thesis before they graduate. The trouble is the structure of our curriculum right now means most students pick their topic. The only free time they have is the summer after their first year. So the vast majority of students would pick some research, do it in the summer after their first year, and then later in their third and fourth year try to write that up as their thesis. Most of them, the vast majority, have picked something else that they're interested in. It's not something that they're going to end up doing. In this new structural model, by frame shifting the clinical year earlier, every student will come back and pick a scholarly project, a research area, more likely in the sort of thing that they're going to do with the rest of their lives. So they could carry that research right into their residency and into the rest of their career. So what we're hoping is that this will actually fuel a higher percentage of our students to become physicians, scientists, humanists, leaders, which is the goal of Harvard Medical School. So there are many, many more things I could say, but let me just close by making another sort of meta observation about what we're trying to do. Because when Dean Flyer asked me if I would consider taking on this role, just as this new curriculum was about to start, I felt like I was stepping on a fast-moving train, you know, and say, okay, you know, let's make this happen. It's been absolutely thrilling, and I consider it the best job in the known galaxy, because what could be better? You have Harvard medical students and Harvard faculty and trying to think about how to create this next generation of leaders who can handle what we just heard about. But when the faculty asked me, okay, you know, what's your philosophy about how we should teach these students? Sometimes they even say, these kids. They're not kids. How should we teach these students? I reflect back, and I think a little bit about the beautiful story that Anthony D'Amico just told, to the fact that, and just a little background, my wife and I have a particular interest in comparative religions. So we travel around the world trying to learn about all the world's religions. And also, you should know, we have three daughters, so that's the background. And so on one of our trips to India to try to learn about Hinduism, we had a teacher who was explaining to us that in the Hindu tradition, there is a philosophy about how you should raise your daughters. And it comes from their belief in reincarnation and the notion that if you believe in reincarnation, because it's quite possible your daughter that you could die while your daughter is still of reproductive age, through most of history that was true, still is sadly for many people, it's at least theoretically possible that you could be reincarnated in your daughter's womb, which gives rise to the philosophy that you should raise your daughter as if you might be raising your own mother. Slightly mind-blowing concept, but stick with me here for just a moment. A little scary. So why do I tell you all that?
We
so
can do that.
When the and they can do that. We have the technology. So why do I say that? So when I meet with the faculty and they say, well, how should we teach our students? Here's what I tell them. I tell them, I don't actually know about reincarnation. But I think that you have to teach your students as if you might be teaching your own doctor. Okay? Now again, I don't know about reincarnation, but I actually do know that given our relative ages, many of us will be facing our final terminal illnesses when they are at the peak of their career. So the real answer is, you have to take it personally. That medical education is not about the transformation of information. Medical education is about the transformation of learners. And people are transformed in relationship. If you want to teach people about ethical issues in reproduction, and you want to teach, we just finished a section in the medical ethics course on ethical issues at the end of life. And when we have these sessions with the students, we spend a lot of time getting to know them as people. And we spend a lot of time, and you would say, this isn't a therapy group, this is a medical school course. But I have news for you. There's a saying that you can't tell a stranger an important truth. You can't tell a stranger an important, you can tell a stranger what the square root of two is. But if you want to teach someone about ethical issues in reproduction, ethical issues at the end of life, and you don't even know that they have a parent or grandparent on a ventilator right now back home, how would you even know what they're hearing when you're talking, right? So this is actually about human relationship. So, you know, if you want to create a curriculum that is and an environment that's capable of preparing the physicians, scientists, humanist leaders for the next century to be able to handle these changes in science and technology, you have to come back to my first preamble. And it's actually not even about the syllabus. It's really about the relationship between the learner and the teacher. And when you create that transforming environment that I talked about, the great thing about a transforming environment is it doesn't just transform the students. It transforms us as the faculty. And that's actually the greatest excitement of all. So why don't we open it up for the panel and discussion at this point? Thank you very much.